Well, thank you, Jane, for that introduction. And can I start by thanking CEDA, Lee, Kelly and her team for the opportunity to speak to you today about Australia's trade outlook. As Jane mentioned, I'm the CEO of AsiaLink Business, which is Australia's national centre for Asia capability. We were set up at the Australian Government, the University of Melbourne and the Maya Foundation to help create an Asia-capable workforce in Australia through delivering market insights, connections, and capabilities to really support deeper engagement with the Asian region. So India is one of 16 priority markets that we cover, and I will definitely cover India over the course of my presentation, as Jane has highlighted. But I would very much like to contextualize it in the context of global growth forecasts, our broader trading portfolio with the Asian region, and some of the major shocks to that trading portfolio that I foresee over the next 12 months. And then speak about three very specific opportunities that we see for our business and for government to work together to activate across Asian markets, across in India, and also in Indonesia as well, recognizing that we, of course, had the president of Indonesia here this week and the ratification of AICIPA, which is the result of several years of significant work. So, I was speaking with my colleague Nicola Gibbs is here today, who helped me with my presentation, and we were discussing how in terms of a future trade outlook for Australia, often you could just start with and end with the 12-month forward forecast for the iron ore price. But it's become a lot more complicated than that, as both Jane and Michael highlighted the impact of ongoing drought across the country, the impact of the bushfire crisis that we've had, and now the coronavirus means that, as we were discussing just before the session commenced, several advisors and economists are now putting the impact of that on the Australian economy at anywhere between $6 to $10 billion when you look at the impact across the agricultural sector, which is still fully to be assessed, across the tourism sector, and of course our international education sector. But to better understand that impact, because that is going to continue to be defined, because I still think we are in the very early stages of that analysis, I think it's important to actually understand the baseline against which that impact will actually be evaluated. So, apologies, it's taking a minute to load. Here we go. So when we look at global growth forecasts, we see that the US, the UK, the Euro region, Japan, and Australia are all expected to grow at anywhere between from 2%, 1.4%, 1.3%, 0.7% in Japan, and about 2.3% in Australia. But when you look at emerging and developing Asia, which is the most important region for us from a trade perspective, that particular region is forecast to grow at about 5.8%. So significantly greater than the US, the UK, the Euro region, Japan, and Australia. What does this 5.8% growth forecast for this year actually mean? There's very moderate acceleration in that growth from 2019, when that region grew at 5.6%. And the reason for that very moderate acceleration being forecast this year is for two main reasons. One is the continued flatlining in China's growth at around 6%, and perhaps even more important now in terms of the impact on that growth forecast of 5.8 is the slowdown in the Indian economy, which is commonly regarded as the fastest growing large economy in the world, which in the third and the fourth quarter of last year started to register growth rates of between 4.5 and 5%. So those are the two big reasons for the very moderate acceleration in growth in emerging and developing Asia, which matters greatly for us from a trade perspective, because 65% of our trading portfolio is focused on Asian economies. China, the Southeast Asian region, Japan, South Korea, India, and other markets. When you look at our composition of trading partners, 7 out of our top 10 trading partners are in Asia. And so the majority of our energy, mining, and agricultural commodities and products and international education and tourism is dominated by the consumption patterns in those economies. And so really understanding trends that are taking place across the world on the impact of that portfolio is really crucial. What's really interesting is, given the significance of the bushfire crisis and the coronavirus, we haven't had any mention so far or any discussion, even over the last few days, about the US-China trade war. It gives you a sense for how significant some of those other matters have now become. But the phase one deal, as many of you will recall, was announced in the not too distant past. And as part of that phase one deal, there are actually some very significant impacts on Australia's trade outlook over the next 12 to 24 months, which should be recognized. So as part of the phase one deal, many of you will be aware, China has about 105 commitments. There are about 88 joint commitments, and there are five commitments that the U.S. has committed to as part of the phase one deal. And the phase one deal is structured across eight chapters, and unsurprisingly, the first few chapters are what everyone has known the trade war is all about, which is about technology and intellectual property. And so those first few chapters are very much focused on commitments in those areas. But it's chapter six on expanding trade that gives us an insight about the impact that the trade war is actually going to have on Australia over the next 12 to 24 months. So what we know is that China has committed to grow its imports from the US in energy products, in agricultural products, in manufactured goods, and in certain areas of the services sector from $92 billion to $200 billion over the next 2 years. And in some of those areas, Brazil, Canada, and Australia will be the most affected. So in LNG, in coal, in cotton, in cereal, areas in which Australia is a major supplier to China, there could be potential impacts. And so that's something that we have to think about and think through over the next 12 to 24 months. But as part of that analysis, we also need to think about our relationship with India, and I'm going to touch on that in the context of not a diversification strategy, which is one of the key points I want to make today. India is not the next China. India is the next India because of its own fundamentals. And so India should not be looked at as a diversification strategy from China, but it should actually be looked at as part of a growth strategy for any firm, industry, or from a broader macroeconomic perspective. Indonesia is the same as well. Indonesia offers its own opportunities, and it is absolutely fantastic that ISIPA has been ratified now by both parliaments, which provides extraordinary access for Australian goods and services exports onto that market. But I would like to highlight that I would absolutely love to see ISIPA complemented by an Indonesia economic strategy, similar to the India economic strategy, for the simple reason that there seems to be a thinking in Australia that if we have a trade agreement, you do not need an economic strategy, when in fact they're two very different things. The India economic strategy authored by Peter Varghese and released at the end of 2018 provided the narrative and the long-term set of opportunities for Australia to consider in the context of that market. A trade agreement, if concluded at some time in the future, will enable certain elements of that strategy, but it is not a strategy in itself. And so when you look at the relationship with Indonesia, ISIPA is incredibly important to deliver long-term efficiencies for firms looking to engage with that market, but there is still a gap in understanding in Australia about the actual opportunities by sector in that particular market, which actually a comprehensive national economic strategy can address. So that's the first thing that I want to highlight to policymakers in the room, that a free trade agreement should not be seen as something that you do instead of an economic strategy, or if there are failed negotiations with a free trade agreement, that you then default to thinking about an economic strategy. They're actually two very different things. Briefly now, I want to touch on the three key opportunities that I believe are very practical things that Australian firms and policymakers can do to activate and actually grow our engagement with the Asian region, which, as I've highlighted, is the fastest growing region in the world and accounts for 65% of our trading portfolio. The first is linked to small and medium-sized enterprises that account for 57% of our GDP, almost 70% of employment, but only account for 4% of the total trade value, only 4%. And what our research highlights that we undertook actually in partnership with the Commonwealth Bank last year is that there is a very specific reason for this, and that is because small and medium-sized enterprises, while they're aware of the opportunities in diverse Asian markets, are not necessarily across the very specific strategies that can actually deliver that uplift in revenue performance, which in turn would be then reflected in the higher trade volume and values that would be reported at that macro level. And so what our research highlighted is that where small and medium-sized enterprises actually include opportunities with Asian markets as a core part of their strategic planning process, those firms actually deliver a 3.5 times greater return on revenues. And when they then, as a result of that strategic planning process, allocate their very scarce resources, taking into consideration the opportunity cost in the home market, very carefully, to their Asia strategy, they can have some very significant uplifts through three very specific strategies. The first is through the attraction, recruitment, and retention of Asia-capable staff. So those small and medium-sized enterprises that actually recruit Asia-capable staff, those with language skills, connections in market, lived experience, relationships with government, all the things that you actually need to execute a strategy, those firms we found were able to deliver revenue outcomes that were almost five times better. Those firms that entered Asian markets customizing their product servicing and their marketing strategies delivered revenue outcomes that were almost eight times better. And those founders and entrepreneurs that decided to visit their market in which they were engaging at least once a month, those firms delivered revenue outcomes that were significantly better than those that engaged only through technology. So what our research highlights is that in order for our SME sector to be more internationally engaged, they need to activate some of these really specific strategies so that they can deliver the revenue outcomes, which in turn will translate to improved trade outcomes. Now, leading into the discussion on India, I want to highlight that while we often highlight that 7 out of our top 10 trading partners are in Asia, it is also true that 7 out of our top 10 investment destinations are not in Asia. So when we think of where we're allocating our capital, it is still in mature, developed markets, which have institutional frameworks that broadly mirror our own institutional frameworks. And so we have a greater degree of trust in allocating capital in those markets. Now, as we think about the future and we think about the risk-adjusted returns that we need to deliver on our capital, it becomes increasingly important that we also have the confidence to invest in Asian markets. And about 2 years ago, we did a landmark study with a couple of partners, PwC and the Institute of Managers and Leaders, that identified in our top 200 biggest companies in this country, the boards and the senior executive teams fundamentally lack the capabilities to engage with Asian markets. We found that 90% of board members and senior executives did not have the fundamental capabilities to engage with Asian markets. So the lived experience, the language skills, the relationships in market, their understanding of the political and economic and social systems was extremely low, so deeply concerning. Now, of course, if you don't have the capabilities, it is impossible to design, develop, and execute strategies and provide confidence to capital markets on a quarterly basis. Now, this is directly relevant. Sorry, it's just frozen. Directly relevant to our India economic strategy, which is a great case study for us, and it is a live case study for us because the Peter Varghese authored India Economic Strategy, which I recommend all of you to read because it's available online. It is 500 plus pages of exceptional analysis broken down by chapter, so you don't have to read it end to end, and done by McKinsey and Company for the government. It is outstanding work. I can't recommend it strongly enough. It's broken into 10 sectors, 10 states of opportunity, and most importantly, having served on Peter's reference group, I was really happy that Peter listened to one key piece of feedback that the reference group gave, which was that strategy without numbers is poetry. And so this is why you need a strategy which says, what are our measures of success, which in 15 years' time we can actually assess the strategy against. And of course, there are many uncertainties, but to not have something that we're working towards collectively is also not helpful. So the vision in that strategy is to grow our exports with India threefold. But I'm most excited about that second measure, which is the first time I know that there has been an outbound investment target set by government. So historically, our relationships have focused on trade and inbound investment attraction. This strategy speaks about growing our trade threefold and exporting 10 times the capital that we today invest in India, from $10 billion to $100 billion, recognizing that the opportunity with India is fundamentally very different to China, which was all about supplying bulk commodities to enable that economy and its export-led agenda, whereas India's is a services and investment-oriented agenda, which means that the opportunity is in India, in India's services economy, and you need to have a presence in India to capture that opportunity, which can only come from investing in that market. Now, in order to do that, we believe that there are three key things that are essential, and this is from our research at AsiaLink Business, that are really essential for the success of the Peter Varghese-led strategy. The first is that there needs to be confidence in the business community that India has actually delivered on its promise. It's not just the macro data of being the world's fastest large economy, but when we have studied the top line, the revenue performance of Indian companies in utilities, in telecommunications, financial services, consumer staples, healthcare, we have found that their revenue performance, their revenue growth year on year is significantly better than ASX 200 companies. And we've also found that their profitability, because the big question asked in Australia, in Australian boardrooms, is who is profitable in India? Who has actually been able to scale their business models to actually succeed in those markets? And it is a good use of Australian capital to actually allocate to our markets such as India. Well, the reality is that Nestle, Unilever, Suzuki, and the list is endless, are companies that have not only established and succeeded in India, but have actually listed their Indian subsidiaries, which have outperformed their parent companies. And that is because they have delivered over time superior earnings per share growth. So India has actually delivered on its promise from a macroeconomic perspective into industry and firm performance. And this is something that we're trying to get our boards and senior executive teams to understand in Australia, because as Peter said, recently, about 3 months ago, reported in the AFR, Corporate Australia is in need of therapy because they're still holding on to anecdotes from 15 and 20 years ago of doing business in India. So hence those data points from recent reporting seasons is actually very important for business executives to actually understand. The second thing in order to execute that strategy is really recognizing that a state-based approach is crucial. And with that, I just want to highlight that there are markets, there are states like Maharashtra, which has a higher GDP than Hong Kong, or Tamil Nadu, which has a higher GDP than New Zealand. And currently, we invest about 10 times more in New Zealand than we do in India. So notwithstanding trans-Tasman linkages, it's quite important that we allocate capital more proportionately. And then finally, I've run out of time, but I recommend that you have a look at this report that's available online. It's on business model innovation. We simply can't transplant our business models in Australia to a place like India. We actually need to understand the opportunity in India and actually customize and develop business models for that market. And this is a report on innovation in medical devices and technologies in India. And it speaks about the type of innovation coming out of India, which is actually driving healthcare innovation globally, and is also something that healthcare experts now in Australia are also taking into consideration. One example on that, Indian hospitals have been able to bring down the cost of open heart surgery down to 2% of the cost of private hospitals, the best private hospitals in the US and in Australia. Here's the most important thing, at a lower mortality rate. What if they can do things at a lower cost and better than us? We have always held on to the notion and strategy that lower cost means lower quality. And they're challenging that in the area in which none of us here would accept low quality, which is in healthcare. And so this is being studied by experts across sectors around the world, because it is really challenging the way in which we look at opportunities across markets. I'm just going to pause there because I'm out of time, but very happy to take any additional questions. But hopefully you've got a few insights there on specific things that we need to do in order to activate opportunities with Asia. Thank you.